Okay, well, I think last time I spoke on this topic, I had a question mark at the end of the title. And I said the question mark was the most important part of the title. But it seems to have got left off this time.
Oh, my mistake.
No, it wasn't your mistake. It was mine. I should have put it on. because I'm still not totally sure I know what it is, the subject. But I can tell people some things and ask people some things. So let's... Twisted strings. Well, I guess people here, at least a lot of people here, know already about this subject and probably know a good deal more than I do, but maybe not looked at from quite the point of view that I want to refer to it. It's a new development of not much over a year, primarily due to Ed Witten, in which twister and string ideas are combined to give new insights and calculational techniques for calculating Yang-Mills gluon scattering amplitudes. Now, at first sight, I wanted to make some comments about my own perspective on this. At first sight, this marriage seems improbable owing to some basic incompatibilities. And these are, well, primarily these two things here, that string theory's dependence on extra spatial dimensions, and the fact that twister theory, one of the guiding motivations right from the start, has been to have a formalism which was specially geared to the three space and one time dimension that we directly observe. So it was all locked into that. It doesn't mean that twister theory only works in three space and one time dimension, but there are some special features about three space and one time dimension which really the theory in any depth does depend upon. So that's always been, the main reason for worrying about bringing these two subjects together. Secondly, there's the question of I'll say more about this later on, but twister theory's dependence on holomorphicity, things being complex analytic, is very crucial. Now, this plays its role also in string theory, but not to the degree that one's meaning here. I'll make some comments here about the complex nature of twister space, which has specifically to do with the signature being 2 mod 4. So if I take the number of space dimensions minus the number of time dimensions, this has to be 2 mod 4 for the twister space to be a complex space. I've put here down basically where this comes from. If you think of spinners, and twisters are a kind of spinner, they're really spinners for the conformal group of the space-time. So you add 1 to S and add 1 to T, and that doesn't make any difference to the difference, S minus T. But what you find is that spinners, or the twisters, for a certain number of dimensions, and if you take that number mod 4, so you have to think about 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, then the space is naturally a real structure in the case of 0, 1, and 7. It's naturally a quaternionic space in the case of 3, 4, and 5. And the only cases really the complex space are where it's 2 or 6 mod 8, in other words, 2 mod 4. So this is just a sort of general point here. And one notices that the dimensions for all the standard string theories, like the old hadronic strings or the superstrings of Schwartz and Green, and the extra dimension, if you talk about M theory, or perhaps 11-dimensional supergravity, or if you had F theory with 2 time dimensions, in all of these cases, you don't find that it belongs to these categories here. So there is a sort of conflict right there. If you're thinking of the complex structure as being vital, which, as I say, doesn't hold unless one has either of these two situations here. Now, strings, of course, are in a certain sense Riemann surfaces, at least that's how they're studied, which are complex one-manifolds. But then when you go to these higher brains, you don't have this complex structure anymore. So that certainly, at least as I understand it, string theory doesn't have this strong connection with holomorphicity that twister theory has. So there are these two things which might indicate some conflict at a basic level. But the thing is that in twister string theory, one does something really quite different, which is why you do get things coming together in this way, that the strings are put in twister space, whose dimensions are not additional to those of space-time. They're already there, according to ordinary space-time geometry. And I'll say something about all this. Now, I'll just make a quick comment about one of my other difficulties with this superdimensionality, which is something which I talked about a few years ago, I guess, whenever it was, 2 years ago, at Stephen Hawking's birthday conference in Cambridge. So that's one place the argument is given, but it's also in this book, The Road to Reality, which is just coming out here in the States. It's been out in non-US, I should say, because I think it's that's the distinction. It's certainly been out in the UK since last late July. And if you have freedom in the extra dimensions, then the argument has always been that you don't excite that freedom without a lot of energy. And the argument here was to say that I don't really agree with that argument, and that I see no reason why there shouldn't be non-linear instabilities which would excite those extra modes. The energy is very small by cosmological standards, and this could lead to non-linear instabilities. In fact, in the classical theory, it certainly does. So these issues seem to be worries if you're regarding these extra dimensions as being something like extra space dimensions. So in any development which somehow suggests that maybe you don't have to look at it that way is certainly exciting to me. So the twister string developments due to Witten and then lots of other people seem to me they're exciting to me in many different ways. One is that they relate to twister theory, which of course is something I've been working on for I guess something like 40 years now, so it's been a big interest for me. Secondly, you don't seem to need the extra space dimensions. Well, that's a question that I'm saying it, but it may be a question. It should have a question mark at the end there. It may be that one can formulate some form of string theory which doesn't require extra space dimensions. And it seems to me a lot of the motivations when you take this different viewpoint are very different. And so it may be one should look at all these things all over again. I don't have anything very definite to say there, but these issues will come up in what I want to talk about. And the third point is that these new ideas seem to have very direct relevance to processes which are physically observable. One's looking at actual, scattering amplitudes and things which could be measured in accelerators and so on and so forth. And this means that you really are sort of doing physics in a strong sense, which is exciting, I guess, both for twister theory and for string theory. So that's a positive feature. So let's put that to the side. And I think, actually, in this talk, I'm going to spend most of my time talking about twister theory. Mainly that's because that's what I know about. But I think the thing is to express these ideas and to try and see how the new string ideas relate to the subject, at least as I understand it, rather than the other way around. That's just because that's where I come to it from. So first of all, I'm not going to assume people know about twister theory here, although I suppose people who work on twister string theory certainly will. But let me say things about twister theory right from the start. Here we have a picture of Minkowski space-time, and one thinks of space-time as being built up out of points, And the view here is not to concentrate on space-time, but think in terms of another space, which is in a certain sense equivalent to the space-time, but it just gives you a different thing to concentrate your attention on. Because they're equivalent, you can do your physics equally well here as over here. Now, the basic idea, just think of a light ray, and a light ray you can represent as a point in some other space, and that's basically what I'm doing here. And then how do you represent a point in space-time? Well, you think of a family of light rays through it, and this family is a two-dimensional family with the topology of a sphere, in fact, with the conformal structure of a sphere. And perhaps I just make a comment about that. This just has to do with this fact that the celestial sphere is basically a conformal sphere. And here I imagine an observer looking out at the universe, seeing a number of stars. And the stars, what you see, are basically correspond to the light rays. So the celestial sphere is the space of light rays through that point. And the key point is that if you think of different observers at this point, sort of observers with different velocities at that point, then the transformation of the sky from one to the other is one which is conformal and serves circles. So circles go to circles. And it's the, if it's conformal, it has to have this second property. In fact, that means that you are justified in thinking of this as a Riemann sphere, or a one-dimensional complex manifold of the simplest kind. The holomorphic transformations of the, or complex analytic transformations of the sphere to itself are exactly the Lorentz transformations corresponding to different velocities here, the non-reflective Lorentz transformations. So this is the thing that one is concentrating on here. Well, the view is basically to think of complex structures. I should say that I mentioned holomorphicity right at the beginning. This is a crucial motivating idea behind twister theory, that somehow the world is to a large extent governed by complex analyticity. And it's not like, we certainly know that in quantum theory this is important, in quantum field theory this can be important. It's not quite like Geoffrey Chew's holomorphic S matrix. It's a different role for holomorphicity. But nevertheless, the idea is that one's thinking of complex analyticity as a powerful guiding underlying principle in physics. And the idea here is that, okay, we know in quantum theory that complex numbers play an important role, but perhaps they also play important roles at a macroscopic level, in fact, in the structure of space-time. And that's the idea here. And so what one is doing is to thinking of this space-time in a different way. You think of the points of this space as representing light rays, and the families of light rays which represent points, these will be things which are naturally thought of as Riemann spheres, so these are complex one-dimensional spaces. This suggests that maybe you could think of the whole space in some sense as a complex space, and these being complex submanifolds of that space. Well, you fall at the first hurdle if you're not prepared to go a little further. That is the fact that the dimensionality of the space of light rays is an odd number of dimensions, namely 5. So this is a 5-dimensional space. And since complex manifolds have to have an even number of dimensions in real terms, that's obviously telling you that this isn't a complex space. But it nearly is. And let me be more explicit about this. Let's, in fact, use the coordinates. Well, this R0 is the time coordinate, and these are the three space coordinates. These are standard Minkowski coordinates. And then you have coordinates over here, which are to be complex numbers, and I'm, for the moment at least, looking at the ratios between those complex coordinates. And we have a relation called incidence between this space and this space, which is given by this fundamental formula in the middle here. So it's a matrix, 2x2 matrix is of the space-time coordinates here. This is I over root 2 for technical reasons. And here we have the twister, these are the twister components over here, and here we have the incidence relation there. Now this incidence relation would hold if these coordinates were allowed to be complex, but if those coordinates are to be real, then that gives you a certain condition, and let me just give you this. Here is the reality condition on R. Well, what you do is you write down the incidence relation that we just had. Just to remind you, that's this one at the top here. And pre-multiply by Z2, complex conjugate of Z2, Z3. And then on this side, we get something because of the I, and because this is a Hermitian matrix, if the R's are real, something which is a purely imaginary number. So that means if you add this thing to its complex conjugate, you must get zero, and that's this equation here. Now that equation is the one that I have written at the bottom on the other side, which is the equation. This whole space here is supposed to represent the space, the twister space, or the projective twister space, which is given by the ratio of these numbers. So it's a three complex dimensional space, or six real dimensions, a three complex dimensional space. And there's a subspace of this, which is given by the vanishing of this Hermitian relation, which I just gave you, which is a necessary condition for the point in this incidence relation to be a real point. So that's the space, you see the color coding is supposed to be precise here. This pink thing here, which does represent the light rays, is this subspace of the complex projective 3 space, which is subspace is given by the vanishing of that Hermitian polynomial. Well, that's a real equation, and therefore that reduces the six real dimensions here down to five real dimensions. And the points of this do represent light rays. That's the picture I've got here. They do represent light rays. There's also a particular line over here which represents light rays at infinity, but let's not worry too much about that. This is actually a conformal description, so you consider a Minkowski space which is compactified by a light cone at infinity, and the points are allowed to be out at infinity as well. So if you allow that, and you then have generators of the light cone at infinity are also counting as light rays, then this correspondence is now exact. You do, however, have an interpretation of the points which don't lie on this subspace representing the light rays. And in fact, this perhaps partly explains the spiral along the line there, or the helix, because this is meant to indicate that if you generalize the notion of a light ray to, and I'll be a bit more explicit about this in a minute, to what you could call a spinning photon, and that photon can spin right-handed or left-handed, where you take into account, say if you normalize the spin so the spin is 1, so or its helicity is plus 1 or minus 1, of the two cases here, then there's one more parameter, which is the energy or the frequency of that photon, and that gives you an extra dimension. So we now have a six-dimensional space, which is very precisely representing the photons in this sense here. And it's conformally invariant picture, so it works nicely. Anyway, that's the description. It stands for null twisters. So yeah, I haven't explained the notation so much here. T stands for twister space, P for projective, and this means that this quadratic form here is positive in this case, and it's negative in this case. And in fact, this is the, we see that this is the helicity in a certain sense. Just a quick remark, which is again a motivational point. I mentioned this particular role for the Riemann sphere as a celestial sphere, but another point, which is a sort of motivational point, is that in some sense there is a connection between the complex parameters of quantum theory and the geometry of physical space. And you see this in, for example, this very simple situation of spin half particle, where the different possible directions of spin, you see you have the different ways in which the axis of spin can be oriented as a linear combination of the two basics, say up and down. And this is a very geometrical thing. One can see that this direction, as I say, it's an eigenstate of a measurement of spin in that direction. And that corresponds to the Riemann sphere of ratios of these two complex amplitudes here. Take the ratio, and that gives you a complex number here, or it's complex number or infinity, and that gives you a whole sphere's worth, which is the sphere's worth of these possible directions here. So I've always thought this is an indication that there is some deep connection between the three-dimensionality of space and the sort of complex amplitudes of quantum theory. This again is a feature particularly of three dimensions. You don't get that direct correspondence in higher dimensions. You say, is it a particular feature of spin half? Well, no, it's not actually, because in higher spin you can represent the states by this Majorana description, which says instead of having just one direction, you have n directions where n over 2 is the total spin. But I'm not really going to talk about that in any detail here, but it was just a motivational point which I wanted to bring up, which again is related to the fact that one is looking here for a description of which directly involves the space which is three-dimensional and not higher than that, which I suppose is one of the reasons I always worried about having to introduce extra spatial dimensions. Okay, well now, to proceed further with twister theory, let's re-express this incidence relation. That's the same incidence relation that I had before, but I'm now going to write this as in terms of two component spinners. So these capital letters here represent two component spinner indices. I always find this very handy because there is a direct translation between the space-time indices, which use a little letter. That is to say, when I write RAA prime, if I'm thinking of this explicitly in terms of components, okay, these each run over two values, say 0 and 1, and that will give me a matrix, which I've written here. But I can also think of these somewhat abstractly as just markers, which is the way that I tend to think of them, and physicists, I think, often do too. Well, mathematicians have a lot of trouble with this, I've found, for some reason. These are meant to be, if you think of these abstract, then you can think of the tensor index is really just the pair AA prime. And why I say this is handy is because you have a direct translation. You don't have to explain it every time you write it down. And you'll see examples of this later when I want to use this. If I write AA prime and I collect them together, that just mean the tensor index or the vector index, four-dimensional index, little a. And the alphabet translates directly. If you use Greek letters for these things, it's kind of awkward because the translation between Greek letters and, if you use the capitals, for instance, then they're confusing. There aren't too many of them which differ from the Roman alphabet and so on. It's just a technical awkwardness about the alphabets, which is one reason I tend to use this way. Of course, you could have had them the other way around and used capital ones for the space-time indices, but nobody ever does that, so I'm not doing that. Okay, but that's just a little bit of notation. So this thing is either a vector, if you like, if I think of this as a single index, or it's representing this tensor product of the spin space and the dual and the complex conjugate spin space. The prime means take complex conjugate. Sometimes people use dots instead. It was a printer who told me to use primes rather than dots. I used to use dots too. This was a long time ago. I wrote my first paper on spinners in general relativity. The pi here stands for these two components, and the omega stands for these two components. There's actually a reason for the choice of letters too, which I'll come to in just a moment. You don't have to stick to that so much, but I think the index choices are quite important. Also, it's quite important which ones are upstairs and which are downstairs. This is really a co-object, which is why it's downstairs. This plays a role when you start to talk about conformal transformations and so on. It doesn't play any particular role at this level if you're just writing down equations. Now this is the twister object here, whose four components are two components from here and two components from here. So these are The Z0 and Z1 are the two components of omega, and the Z2 and Z3 are the two components of pi. And this is just the incidence relation written in terms of the omegas and pi. There it is down here. If you shift the origin, then you find that the pi's don't get affected, basically telling you which direction the thing's going in, whereas the omega does shift in this very specific way. So if I move from O to Q, where the position vector of Q relative to O is little q, then this is the way that the omegas must transform. Now the complex conjugate of a twister, for that I not just take the complex conjugates and remember that the primes, these refer to complex conjugate twister spin space. So if there was a prime originally, it disappears this, when you take complex conjugate. If there wasn't one originally, then it acquires one. But the other thing is you have to swap these two around. So the omega and pi go the other way around. And this gives you the expression before. Let me just show you this again. Remember this little calculation I did here to obtain the equation of Pn. That now is written that way, where I didn't actually refer to this here, but you see complex conjugate of the twister, these are the four components of this twister, and this one is the complex conjugate of that one. So these two are complex conjugates of these two, and these two are the complex conjugates of these two. So you have to swap them around, and that's exactly what's going on here. When I take z bar, that's the conjugate twister, I have to swap the pi and omega around, and that's handy because when you want to make this twister norm, which is the z bar, this thing now is dual to that one, so that's you can just contract them together, and these ones is likewise. So it's this scalar product with that plus this scalar product with this is the norm, and its vanishing defines Pn. So that's the thing we had before. Now, if you want the physical interpretation of twisters, and this is really rather important because it sort of governs a lot of things that you actually do in the subject, it describes the momentum and angular momentum for a massless particle. So a massless particle has a momentum which is a null vector with the zero component, that's the time component, in with the signature that I use at least, being positive. That means it points into the future cone, or points along the future cone. This thing here is the Pauli-Lubanski spin vector, this being the skew symmetrical Levi-Civita object. And so you just make this expression here, that's the Pauli-Lubanski vector. And for a self-respecting massless particle, you want this Pauli-Lubanski spin vector to be proportional to the momentum. It's normally orthogonal to the momentum, and it's still orthogonal to the momentum here. But since this momentum vector is a null vector, that's fine. It is. So that's OK. Now what you find, you see, this is slightly awkward if you wanted to use a tensor notation or a tensor description, because there are several conditions you have to satisfy. Well, this one and this one and this one. And you have to satisfy all those at once. And these are nonlinear relations, which makes it a little awkward. But one of the advantages of twister theory is that you can do this all very neatly. Here are these two objects, omega and pi. And from them, you can construct, first of all, take pi bar, and that gives you the momentum. This is automatically a future pointing null vector. So these two conditions are satisfied. And any future pointing null vector is described in this way. Incidentally, that explains the choice of pi, because it's the Greek form of p. The angular momentum, which has to satisfy this condition here, is obtained by this thing here. You take What you find is that for this to hold, this thing here, you need this thing to be of that form, where omega is some new spinner. And in fact, that's the definition of the omega here. Or the other way around, you can say if you know omega and pi, this is the definition of the angular momentum, and that automatically satisfies. All these relations are now automatically satisfied. Where the omega and pi are completely free, the only condition being that pi mustn't be zero. If pi is zero, that gives you a limiting case, which is not a physical massless particle, if you like. And there is a freedom in omega and pi, which is a phase. That is to say, you can multiply the whole thing, the z, by e to the I theta, and you don't see that in these expressions. That's the only freedom that there is. So that apart from that phase freedom, the twister is completely equivalent to this object here, a massless entity. So if you like, that's the reason for what I was saying back here. If you say, demand that, I think I have something I didn't remember to say. Let's say it now, because I thought it would be written down here, and I don't. I only see it in the quantized form. This thing here, which is the helicity, that little s, is actually a half zz bar. So it is this object here. That's the helicity. Now, if the helicity is zero, then you're on this subspace here. If the helicity is positive, you're in the top half. That means this thing is now positive. If the helicity is negative, you're in the bottom half. If you normalize the modulus of helicity to have a particular value, then you can see that the remaining, as in the photon, it would be 1. Then you see in the remaining freedom is given by the energy of that photon. So that justifies this picture that I have here. So that all comes down to the expression that I've given you here. That determines the whole of the projective twister space in physical terms. Now, here I've gone a little further, and I've talked about quantization. That is, if you like, first quantization, where you're thinking of the z's as replacing the normal position of momentum for a massless particle. And what you find, I suppose, a slightly strong statement, but what you find works is you take the z's to be canonically conjugate, to the z's and the z-bars to be canonically conjugate. So z and z-bar are conjugate variables having a Kronecker delta as their commutator, and the z's commute among themselves and the z-bars commute among themselves. And then you find that everything goes through as I had before. I didn't actually say this, but when you move your origin, the angular momentum transforms as it should. And I should say the choice of the letter omega has to do with the fact that omega tends to be used for angular momentum. So that's the reason for that, too. And you find that all these relations still hold with these commutators. That's not doesn't affect anything. The only thing it does slightly affect is the definition of the helicity. So you just define the helicity to be given by this expression, and then you find it's this. So you do have to worry about the order of the operators at that point. So the helicity is given by this expression, which you can then rewrite by commuting the z's and z-bars. And if you use a z description, then the z-bar becomes minus 1 over, with an h-bar in it, d by dz. And then this thing here, zz-bar, becomes this operator here. So you can see the helicity is given by that operator expression. Now, the significance of that I'll come to in just a moment. In fact, here, twister wave functions. Now, since z and z bar, or I times z bar, are conjugate variables, a twister wave function, f, ought to depend on either z or z bar, but not both, like you want your wave function to be a function of momentum or a function of position, but not both at once. Well, just the first point is, what does it mean to say that f of z does not depend on z bar? Well, the condition that it's independent of it, in a sense, is df by dz bar equals naught, and these are just the Cauchy-Riemann equations asserting that f is holomorphic. So this gives you this natural, the wave functions that you're talking about are naturally holomorphic objects, complex analytic objects. If you want this thing to be a helicity eigenstate, well, these are to be the eigenstates of this operator. Remember, this was on the previous transparency. This was the helicity operator, was that. Oops, I said that is, there's a mistake there. There should be a Z in that. This thing is the Euler homogeneity operator whose eigenstates are homogeneous functions. And that's the thing which appears here. So the eigenvalue is the degree of homogeneity. So let's take n, which we expect to be an integer. That's 2s over h. This is the eigenvalue for your helicity. If you want that to represent the helicity, then f will turn out to be homogeneous, holomorphic in z, of degree minus 2 minus n. So it's automatically holomorphic because wave functions of twisters should be holomorphic. It's homogeneous if you want it to be an eigenstate of helicity, and the degree of homogeneity is minus 2 minus n. So n is an integer which is basically twice the value of the helicity. Alternatively, if you like, you could choose the z-bar description. There's another misprint. Don't have a bar in it. You could use the, it's like saying you could use a position space representation or you could use a momentum space representation. If I use the w's, that's momentum. You know, it's like saying momentum. But of course, they're much more on equal footing here. You could use z-bar if you wanted to, and let's call it W so as not to have all those bars all over the place. And rather than saying anti-holomorphic in Z is what you would say there, you say holomorphic in W. It's a more natural way of thinking about it. So you can use this description or you can use the other description, whichever you like. Then you find the F, the wave functions holomorphic now of degree minus 2 plus N. You have to make a choice. You can't use one or the other as you feel like. That would be like using position states sometimes and momentum states sometimes in the same expression. This has some relevance to how you might think about helicities which aren't the way around that you want them to be. And I'll come to that. Okay, well, how does this relate to ordinary space-time descriptions? And these are the various wave equations written in two-spinner notation for massless particle of different possible helicities. When the helicity is zero, you just get the wave function, the wave operator. So this is a solution of the Dannenbergian vanishing. If you take negative helicity, then you can use a spinner which is symmetrical in minus n indices. N is negative, so of course that's a positive number of indices, which is symmetric, and this is the field equation. If n is positive, then I'm going to use primed indices, and that's the field equation. Now, just to see what the twister wave functions, how the homogeneities would compare, and so on, and what kind of things we're talking about. If you have a Maxwell field, so this is helicity plus or minus 1, then you can take the field tensor and write it this way. Remember, this was if you see an A and you see an A prime, you can clump them together and call that a space-time A. You can put in your translation symbols if you want to use components, but that's just makes the formula look more complicated. But you have to bear in mind that this thing is skew, and the epsilons, those are the things that you use to raise and lower indices in two-component spinner notation. These things are skew-symmetrical. That's sort of Levi-Civita object. These are skew-symmetrical. And this then has to be symmetrical to compensate, to give you that anti-symmetrical. And there are two parts to it. There's this part and this part. This is the anti-self-dual part, and this is the self-dual part. So you're splitting F into its anti-self-dual part and its self-dual part. And if you want to think of this as a wave function, this would correspond to the left-handed part of the photon, and this is the right-handed part of the photon. The psi and the phi are both symmetrical, and the Maxwell free field equations are precisely the equations I've got written down here in this particular case with two indices. So you now have helicity being plus 1 or minus 1, and from the formula I gave you, the homogeneity in Z would be minus 4 or 0, and if you chose the other description, it would be 0 or minus 4 the other way around. Now, you might think about spin 2 if you're concerned with gravity. Well, linearized gravity, so you might think of a wave function. You might choose to use linear gravity for that. It's, if you like, the complex first-order curvature, so you're looking at first-order deviations from flat space. Then this is the first-order curvature, deviation from flat space, and you write it like this. This thing has a lot of complicated symmetries. It's skew in those indices, skew in those, and symmetric under interchange, and the skew part of ABC vanishes. And all traces have to vanish as well. That's quite complicated, but everything is very neatly described in the two-spinner notation. It's just this, where this psi has four symmetrical indices, and these are two epsilons now, and you have to see that that pairs with that, and that pairs with that, which means that the first two indices are going to be skew, that's the A, the second, so the A and B, that is, the second two indices are going to be skew as well, that's the C and D, and the same thing will hold over here, but the other way around, and this also has all its traces vanishing automatically. The anti-self-dual part describes the left-handed gravitons, that's homogeneity degree minus 2, and the, I'm sorry, that's helicity minus 2, the right-handed part is helicity plus 2, and in the function, the twister function of Z will be of homogeneity degree plus 2 or minus 6, according to whether it's left-handed or right-handed. And then you have massless neutrinos, antineutrinos, there's again special cases of these equations, or the scalar wave which you had at the top. Okay, so that just shows how you would want to translate. It doesn't show how we're going to translate, so I have to give you that. How do we do the translation? Well, this is done through a contour integral, which I've done first for the scalar case, although I wasn't aware of these things until much later. The formula in the scalar case was essentially known to Whittaker in almost the turn of the 20th century, so over 100 years ago it was known. He was quite famous for it at the time, although it got forgotten very much after. He didn't write it as a contour integral, but it was an expression equivalent to this thing. And then Bateman followed up on this. I think Whittaker did it in three dimensions for the Laplace equation. Bateman did it for the four-dimensional wave equation. And then, later on, actually did it for the Maxwell equations, too. So he knew, not quite in this form, but he basically knew this formula.
And that, their motivation?
Well, Bateman was just interested in solving the equations, I think. I think that was, in both cases, it's a neat way of solving the Laplace equation or the D'Alembert equation for Maxwell's equation. Bateman, he wrote a book on Maxwell, and he depended a fair degree on this formula. Well, I wasn't aware of any of these things first, but and then Lane Houston also did part of this later on. I'll explain a bit about that. There are two versions of this contour integral formula. Depending on what you want to do, there's the homogeneous version or the inhomogeneous version. The homogeneous version is what people almost always talk about. That depends on the homogeneities all working out. I'll say a bit about that. The inhomogeneous version is rather more general and more, in a sense, appropriate. I'll say why it's more appropriate. The point about this one is, although the integral is two-dimensional, you see you've got the two components independently, and here, in this case, you've only got one integral. In this case, you can express, say, a photon which doesn't have circular polarization. You see, normally, after all, you might think about photons which have linear polarization, in which case that involves an equal combination of being left-handed and right-handed. So that in the twister formalism, you'd have to combine a function homogeneous of degree minus 4 with a function homogeneous of degree 0. And you can't directly write down this expression in that case, because that means you've fixed your helicity, and you can't add the two together, because that isn't homogeneous. But if you use the inhomogeneous version, you can write the two things together, and there's no problem. It's just the contour integral picks out the right piece for the right thing, and that seems to be the right thing to do. I just mentioned that because this is in other things one likes to do in twister theory, this turns out to be much more powerful and flexible and enables you to do things which are very hard to do this. But this is the version almost always described by people. So I make that point here, just as a word of warning, if you like. Now here we have, let's cover this up for the moment, not to confuse people too much. Here we have how this expression should be generalized when we include helicity. So you just pile in a whole lot of pi's, and if you remember what the homogeneities were, this does the trick, because you want something so that this thing is has a total homogeneity 0. I should have mentioned that here. You see, this would be minus 2 for the scalar case, and this has homogeneity degree plus 2, because there are two pi's over there, whichever form you take. Now what you do, let's talk about this just for a moment. I didn't quite finish talking about it. What you do is you first of all put the incidence formula in. You see, this is a function of a twister, so you put in the incidence formula for the omega, and that makes it a function of pi and x. And then the integral integrates out the x, so you have now have a function of x. So that's how you get a space-time description out of your twister formula. Now, that works whichever one of these you use. Now you can put in a lot of pi's, but bear in mind that if you've got n of those, that these will give you a homogeneity of degree n, but there are two over here, so you see the minus 2 minus n for the f compensates exactly for the n here and the 2 there. So again, you substitute the incidence relation in for omega, now it's a function of pi, you integrate out the pi's, and there you have this thing. And the point I should make is that the field equations are automatically satisfied. So although I wrote these down here before and didn't quite refer to them, those field equations that one has here follow immediately and totally trivially from the expressions that one has here. If you want the negative helicity case, you put d by d omegas. These things look rather different, but in a certain sense it's a natural thing, because you might say, well, go to the complex conjugate. These would all be pi bars. You're not allowed to have pi bars, because this is meant to be a contour integral. It's got to be a holomorphic object. So you go to the quantization rule, tells you to do d by d omega instead. So it's quite natural, if you like, from that framework. But of course, these, the homogeneity is the other way around, so you want to have a plus. You want to balance these the other way, and that formula comes out as it should. Now, just to give you a feeling for what these things look like, this is the sort of canonical case. It's an example of what we call an elementary state. It's simply 1 over 2 linear expressions, product of them. And the green, this factor here vanishes when z is on the green plane. This one vanishes when z is on the orange plane. And as long as your line, which is, remember, represents a point in space-time, as long as that line, just a point of, sometimes I write these things, draw these things as long sausages because they're really Riemann spheres. Sometimes I just draw them as lines because that's what they are in this complex projective space. But that's just to describe my, explain my pictures a little bit. This line here is a Riemann sphere, and I've just drawn it looking more like a Riemann sphere over here. And it has two poles which correspond to these two factors here, here and here. Your contour integral then runs between them. It has to separate the two. If it didn't separate them, then your contour would just slip down to zero and you get zero as an answer. So to have a non-trivial answer, you have to have singularities on both sides. And you find that this function gives you an example of a solution of the wave equation, I think, which is due to Lanczos, particularly if you take this to be an appropriate place. If you take that in the bottom half of twister space, then you find this the lines in the top half never meet it, and you get therefore the one PN never meet it, and so you have a completely non-singular wave. It sort of comes in and goes out like that, and you can make it of positive frequency. Well, that's the sort of thing I'm doing down here. In general, if you want to make a positive frequency wave function, as indeed your wave functions should be for free waves, you generalize this, so I don't just have two planes of singularities, but they can be kind of smeared out and be more bigger things. And provided they're separated in the top half, you see, I've got two mountain peaks or a camel or something there, and if this is, well, think of the two mountain peaks and this little clouds down there, if you like, but this line just notices these two separate mountain peaks, and it intersects there. The sphere here that you've got has two separated regions of singularity, and again you can find your contour to separate them. So the line, as long as it remains in the top half of the space, will always give you a value of the field which isn't singular. It will also automatically be positive frequency, because the lines, I haven't said this in detail, but the lines in the top half of twister space correspond to points in the forward tube. These are the points in complex Minkowski space with past pointing imaginary parts. And one way of saying that your function is of positive frequency is to say that it extends holomorphically into the forward tube. And this automatically gives you this. Now, I should say that a lot of this here was very much part of the original motivation of twister theory. It took quite a while for it to be realized, but the motivation of twister theory, one of the big motivations, was to try and express this notion of positive frequency in a way which was geometrical and global for the whole space. And indeed, that's what this does. In the canonical case, yes. You mean the B itself? Yes. Well, it is one of these Robinson congruences. It's a complicated looking thing, because you've got these pictures that I like to draw with this lines all over the place. Yes. No, you can certainly describe it. But I don't think those things were known to Lanczos when he produced this thing. But they're nice waves, because they are positive frequency and they're finite norm. So you can, it's one of the things one was trying to do in twister theory is not to try to make everything as finite as you can. And that includes the delta functions that one normally doesn't mind in quantum field theory. You usually put the momentum delta functions in but here, one of the motivations is to keep everything absolutely finite. So if anything is going to go to infinity, you can see the reason why, in a sense, more clearly. So these elementary states are basic to the subject of how one does quantum field theory and twister theory. I haven't been keeping track of the time. Let's see, when am I supposed to? I'm just about run out of time, is that right? Yes, okay, yes, I can see various people have to do that. Well, I hope I can. Can I go just on for a little more? I don't know how. I was just talking without quite realizing how long this is. I know, well, you see, I'm putting it off as long as possible. No. Yes, well, let me say quickly a little bit more about twisters. That's
also, you have a lecture.
I know I have, so I shouldn't talk. That's another reason, a more important reason for me for why I shouldn't talk too long. Let me just make a comment or two about this. Oh, that's even more important. Let me just say, yes, I thought I was having to say too much here, but that's the trouble. Twister theory involves a lot of ideas. Now I want to describe in a more profound way what we're talking about here. You see, to have singularities which split into two halves is a kind of mess, really, if you want to treat that mathematically, particularly because you might want to add together functions. After all, wave functions form a linear space, and so if you want to add them together, you want to make sure that your singularities don't crowd each other out and prevent you from doing contour integrals and so on. So what you want is really a more general perspective on what's going on here. And this picture is supposed to be describing at least one approach to that more general perspective. Instead of thinking about singularities and separated regions, you think of the domain of definition of F, which is in this place all dotted with these purple spots, is the intersection of two open regions whose union is the whole space. So what you've got is a covering of this whole space by two open regions, and you're interested in functions defined on the overlaps. Now, you can, if you add these things, you tend to find they chop each other up into pieces, the different regions, and you're led to coverings with more than two open sets. And then what you have to do is to consider your wave function, a whole collection of these Fs, where each F is on an overlap of two regions that have to satisfy conditional triple overlaps, and they have a condition that two of these collections of Fs are equivalent if they differ by what's called a co-boundary here. And this is what's called sheaf cohomology, but I won't worry you about the names too much. You can then do contour integrals, which are branched, or more interesting is you can non-linearize. If you're lucky, you can form a non-linear version of these things. And here's an example of what you do. You simply take your patches and start sliding them over each other. The vector fields now replace the Fs. And you can build a manifold this way. This condition here becomes the condition that, this is the consistency condition on triple overlaps that you want for building a manifold for all these triple overlaps. And this is the condition that your deformation, if you like, is non-trivial. So this is one reason why you're interested in doing this. And it also leads you into general relativity, where if you take these deformations to have a particular form, this is for a plus 2 homogeneity. If you remember, for a graviton, you want plus 2 for the left-handed graviton. So this gives you the anti-self-dual deformations of flat space, and it gives you what's called the nonlinear graviton. I won't go into this here. But if you want the self-dual parts, and this is what's called the googly problem, then you have to think of some way of putting your minus 6 function in. Well, what I've said in blue here is it's a true statement, but it falls short of what one would want to do. Well, for an asymptotically flat curved vacuum space-time, the full gravitational field is encoded geometrically, but rather strangely, in the structure of a deformed twister space using these two types of deformation here, one for the left-handed and one for the right-handed part. Yet it's not clear how to retrieve the space-time from the twister space. So this is sort of ongoing, I'm afraid.
Does it change if you have a cosmological constant, positive
and negative? It does. That's a significant point. In fact, I don't know how to do this part when there's a cosmological constant. So that sort of worried me a bit. I'm not, well...
It doesn't get better.
It doesn't get better. No, oh, I see, you want it to get better. Oh, I see. Yes, that would be nice, yes. Maybe it does. But the thing is, I did all this stuff before I realized there was a cosmological constant. This was before these observations, which seem to indicate that there is one. So I have to think about these problems all over again. But they're very much geared to looking at asymptotically flat spaces. Well, part of the construction isn't, and part of it's quite general. But to complete the construction, I had to use asymptotically flat. And if you've got a cosmological constant, it's not asymptotically flat. You have asymptotically de Sitter, and then you have to worry about the scry being space-like and not null, and so on. So it raises issues, which are not resolved yet.
Is supersymmetry somehow giving up those
cases? Well, it relates to twister theory in some ways, and certainly even the early the West-Zumino early approach to supersymmetry, well, they rediscovered twisters and what they did. So there are connections with twisters, between twisters and supersymmetry. In fact, the little that I want to say, I'm afraid I can't say very much just because I've got no time, but I wanted to say these are mainly references, which probably I wouldn't worry about. But the sort of thing you want to do now, remember that a line in twister space represents a point in space-time, or maybe complex space-time. And you might imagine generalizing this to Riemann surfaces of higher degree, which there's certainly lots of, which are still genus zero. There are certainly those examples. And as I understand it, all the successful twister string calculations that have been done have been done with these genus zero objects, unless there's some more work I don't know about. But you would expect to look at higher genus as well when you're thinking about closed loops and so on. See, the point of view, as I understand it, with twisted string theory, is that here's a natural place for putting things like strings. And it's been in the backs of our minds for a long time that you might want to do this sort of thing. But quite how you would do it and for exactly what purpose hasn't been clear. But Witten seems to have introduced ideas of that kind, which do seem to make some sense and do seem to work. Although completely it's not quite clear. But the idea is that you want to generalize lines somehow to include these higher dimensional objects as well. Now, in their calculations, they look at these gluon scatterings and so on. I just wanted to make a point here for those that know something about this area. That they've been talking about these things, MHV, that stands for maximum helicity violating. So you're thinking of a vertex, basically, where these gluons come in, and all but two of them have the same helicity. Well, these are, you reverse the helicity if it's the opposite direction in time. That's the normal conventions. But if you imagine these things coming into a vertex, and two of them have the opposite helicity, and the calculations that had to be that were being done and seemed to be remarkably simple were initially with these MHV objects, and then you stick these together to produce higher things. But Andrew Hodges, who's been looking at twister diagrams, these are things he's been the twister diagram expert for many, many years, and the subject has been sort of grinding to a halt from the lack of some new inspiration, which seems to be what's perhaps coming in here. And he's now been fired into action again, and looking at a lot of things he'd done before, and a lot of new ideas have come along. And one of these seems to be that you can quite quickly obtain all the amplitudes, whether MHV or not. So you don't need these maximum violating condition on the things. You just have errors coming in and out randomly, and you can write down in a very simple way what these general amplitudes are. This seems to be something which is new over and above what people had done before. But I'm not in a position to talk about it here because it's very recent. In fact, it was only just this week, I think, when the last thing I saw, which he talked about it in a lecture, which I wasn't able to attend, but he has got some new results here. Let me make a comment about the supersymmetry, because this is a question which is of significance here. I sort of worry about how important this is, partly because, although I don't have arguments like the ones against higher dimensions, which make me worry seriously about extra dimensions if they're fully dynamical, supersymmetry, I don't have any such argument. Maybe supersymmetry is true of nature. The only thing that worries me there is that people don't seem to have seen it, in the sense that they don't see the partners to particles. But nevertheless, there may be some elements of supersymmetry in the internal parts of diagrams which don't show up as partners to actual particles. And that would fit in quite well with a lot of things that Andrew Hodges has been doing too. So I think that the things that I'm referring to here also do involve certain N equals 4 supersymmetry, I think, seems to be sort of naturally fits into this. But it's only for the internal parts of the diagram. It's not sure what it says about actual particles. I should say another point here. Dodging backwards and forwards a bit. That when Witten and company look at these things, they actually do something which isn't quite what a twister theorist would say you should do. And this is tied up with the fact that preliminary, he pretends in a certain sense that space-time has the wrong signature. Now, of course, this is a familiar thing to do in quantum field theory when people say, take Euclidean signature, and then you imagine your Wick rotation will give you the things you want for Lorentzian signature. Well, this is something which is almost the opposite, because what Witten says is, let's take plus plus minus minus signature. So there are two space and two time dimensions. The reason, or at least I don't know if it's his reason, but a reason for doing this, is that then the twister theory is all real, and you can see it all, and your twister space can be a real space and everything. But the motivations that I was stressing earlier on in this talk now disappear, because this dividing of the space into two halves and enforcing the positive frequency and all that now vanishes. You don't have that. That's a very specifically Lorentzian condition. So if you're looking now at what we would well, a split signature, plus plus minus minus space-time, that gives you a quite different twister theory as far as the real structure is concerned. And then the thing that people tend to do here is to construct, you start from a momentum state and you want to produce a twister function. And what they tend to do is, we'll write this as in terms of the pi and the pi bar, and then you Fourier transform on half of this. Now, as Lionel Mason points out, this is not really the transform that's used in twister theory. It's what's called the X-ray transform. And although it's a perfectly respectable transform, it's different from what, in a sense, one should be doing. Now, there are certain problems that one eventually starts to run into with things looking as though they should be real when you want to involve them, complex roots, complex poles and things and so on. And it looks as though the reason that you run into these problems is that you're not really doing the right signature. And my advice would certainly be to try and do everything with the right signature right from the start, because twister theory is really geared to that. In fact, it's geared to a number of things, some of which might partly explain the value in using these ideas here, which might have nothing to do with string theory. They might have very little to do with twister theory either. So it's not quite clear. The fact that people obtain these very nice results, what does that really depend upon? And I think there's still a bit of a mystery there. You see, it's quite useful to use twisters, because twisters, as I've explained, are geared to looking at helicity states. And so in these amplitudes, you're looking at things which are helicity states. And it's all crying out, well, use twisters, because this is the right kind of formalism to use for this kind of problem. It doesn't say necessarily that the twister string approach is telling you something significant. On the other hand, the way which people calculate these amplitudes do depend on looking at these, at least some of the waves depend on looking at these higher order curves and thinking of these amplitudes in some sense being based on these curves. And it does depend to some extent also on this statement here. So I think a lot of this needs to be re-examined. I'm afraid I'm rushing through this at the end, partly because I have no time, and partly because the things that I want to say are pretty general anyway. I'll make a more specific comment. Let's just see. I did have a transparency up there which I didn't finish talking about, didn't I? It's probably this one. If you want to talk about higher order curves or higher degree curves in projective twister space, there is a way of doing it which is takes me back to my PhD, actually, because I was playing around with these things in those days. You can't write down an equation for a curve in general, because it's a space curve. You see, if you want to describe a thing called a twisted cubic, for instance, that's a cubic curve which twists around in a way like this. Well, you can't express it as the intersection of two surfaces and so on. So you can't write down an equation in the ordinary way. But there is this way of writing down an equation for it, which was, I was brought up to call it the Cayley form, because in fact Cayley did it first. Chow later on worked on this. But the idea is, if you want to describe this curve in space, you can write an equation for it, which is the condition that it should meet a line in the space, a straight line. And that's one condition, and you can show that this is always a single polynomial. So you can play with those things. And I don't think anybody has done that yet. It's a certain approach that one could do. When I say I don't think I've done it in twister string theory. So let me just make that comment. I won't follow that up in detail. I think I'll make just a couple further comments, and then I think I'll shut up. This is an interesting point that was related to a point made to me by Michael Attia some years ago, which relates to the twister string idea. If you want to know how much freedom there is, if your curve is order or degree, I was brought up to call it order, which there are reasons for that, but people seem to call it degree these days. So if you take a curve of degree one, it has to be a straight line in twister space, projective twister space. And how much freedom is there? Well, it's four parameters, 4 degrees of freedom. Okay. Gives you the four-dimensional space-time, if you like. If n equals 2, there are two possibilities. You can take two skew lines, and then it has 8 degrees of freedom, because there's 4 for each. Or you can take a conic, that is a curve of degree 2, which has to lie in a plane. And that also has 8 degrees of freedom. They can degenerate into the same thing. You can make two lines intersect, or you can make this conic become a pair of lines, and that's the common degeneration of these two. And that's useful in twisted string theory, because you can do your integrals for the amplitudes either in this case or this case, and you get the same answer by looking at the common degeneration. What about n equals 3? We can take three lines, that's 12 degrees of freedom, two lines, one line in the conic, that's 12 again, a twisted cubic, that's the curve I was talking about before, or a plane cubic. Now this is the first case where you arise at a genus more than zero. So if you're looking at loops and things, then you would look at this case here. That's the first case where you get genus more than zero. What about n equals 4? Well, n equals 4, I think I'll do this in the sort of dramatic way people like to do with covering up their transparencies. You can take four lines and they have 16 degrees of freedom. You can take two lines in the conic, again 16, two conics. You can take a line in a twisted cubic, that's 16. You can take, this is the first really new case, you can take an elliptic quartic, that's the intersection of two quadratic surfaces, two quadric surfaces. And that's an elliptic curve, so you've got the loop, if you like. Or you can take a rational quartic, this is genus 0 again, the green numbers refer to the genus. And again, the freedom is the same as before, 16 parameters. You can take a line and a cubic, an elliptic cubic curve in a plane, again 16. Notice they're always the same number of degrees of freedom. One last case, and that is the plane quartic curve, genus 3, has 17 degrees of freedom. So that's the thing is, I remembered Michael Atiyah mentioning to me that all these things always gave you the same numbers, and I just didn't bother to work this out till fairly recently, and I realized this actually doesn't give you the same reason. But there's a clear reason why this is so, and this has to do with the degenerations, because you can make these things intersect, and each time they intersect, you lose a degree of freedom. Each time you require a node, you lose a degree of freedom. So you can go one way, you can go the other way. The only thing is that if you degenerate this by making them intersect, you see, you can make this intersect with that, this one intersect with that, this with that, this with that, this with that, and then the last one automatically happens, because if you have four lines like that and all of them but two meet, the last one automatically meets. So you actually you have just a little bit more freedom than you thought you had in the degeneration, and that's just matches with the 17 here. So all the other cases, when you degenerate in this way, you'll find that there is, just at the end, a place where you don't actually restrict the degree of freedom. But in this case, you see it, because this is just making nodes and so on. And if you go to the next case, which is n equals 5, you see the ones at the end start getting higher number of degrees of freedom. I'll just make this point because people have looked at their twister string theory in I forget which cases. It's probably maybe up to n equals 3, is it? No, well, they've looked at the rational curves in these different cases. But it might be that you're going to start to see sort of different things happening when you're looking at higher order and so on.
These curves are the same as the Riemann surfaces?
They're all Riemann surfaces, yes. When I call them curves, I should say they're all Riemann surfaces. And the genus of the Riemann surface, yeah, I'm talking about Riemann surfaces. See, they're complex curves.
Do they have a space-time description? Like, for example,
they do. Well, that's a good question. They have, but it's not a natural thing. It's the sort of thing, certainly they all have space-time descriptions, but there's some crazy thing that you'd never think of. The line is just a point. The conic even is a funny thing. You can think of the condition, it's a sort of family of lines meeting some great mess of a thing. I haven't followed it up in detail, but they certainly do have space-time descriptions, but they're not the obvious thing you think of. So this is a place where twister theory will lead you in a different direction from what you might have done otherwise. But I guess the point I'm trying to make, which I find kind of exciting, is that maybe string theory doesn't need to be done in extra space dimensions, which I have a lot of trouble with. And all the remarkable things that do seem to come out of string theory maybe would still come out in a different form if you think of them as happening in twister space. Twister space is there automatically because it's just another way of describing ordinary space-time, at least in flat space it is. So It's not as though there are extra spaces hanging around on the space-time. It's just a reinterpretation of what's going on in your space-time. And so maybe you can make a decent theory out of strings inhabiting that space. And then there are differences because, for example, and I did have a transparency about this, but I shouldn't be saying more time. For example, what about the anomalies? See, the initial ideas, I think one of my transparencies disappeared, oh, that was it. You wanted some, to preserve some parameterization invariance and so on. And that makes a lot of sense if you're looking at abstract strings. But if you're looking for a string in twister space, well, it does in a certain sense make, if you want a theory which is conformally invariant, then you do want parameterization invariance. But if you want a theory where you can throw away conformal invariance, then in some sense you have a natural parameterization on your curves. And so maybe the arguments that say you want to get rid of certain anomalies don't hold with this different philosophy. I guess the point I'm trying to make is there's just a general, maybe we should start all over again and say, if you think of your strings as in twister space, what happens to the motivations all along the chain in string theory, which drive you to looking at higher dimensions, maybe supersymmetry, but supersymmetry certainly plays a role here, or it could do. So
those motivations for string had to do with being extended objects in space-time.
Well, that's what they always were. Sorry, is that what you're saying?
A lot of the motivations for string
yes.
theory had to do with the strings being extended objects in space-time.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yes, yes, that's right. So now you
have extended objects in twister space.
That's right, yes. So I'm saying that drives you in quite different directions. So if you take the way that string theory has been guided, and then you ask again, are those different turnings that have been made right through the history of the subject, are they going to be changed in some way, or do they survive in their original form? And I think it's a project, and it's to have a look at. And
well,
does
it's based on string and twister space.
Well, that's right. You think of the string as in twister space, but it's not a space-time string.
Space-time string transformed back to space?
Yes. You can certainly do that, yes. They correspond to... off the top of my head, I've forgotten, but I certainly have looked at it, yes. You do get structures in twister space which correspond to strings in space-time, yeah. But they're not simple strings in twister space. They're more complicated things, yes. So I'm afraid that's... on the string side, I'd like to say a lot more because I feel there is a lot more to be said, but I don't know most of it.
Can one formulate theory on twister space?
You can certainly. Yes, that's actually a point I should make here. You can certainly proceed in doing quantum field theory. It's not exactly quantum field theory on twister space, but it's you can certainly do quantum field theory in twister terms. And in fact, if you like, the twister diagrams that Andrew Hodges worked with are one way of realizing this. But they tend not to be a sort of self-contained subject. You might say, well, you like to do it purely independently in twister theory. But what Hodges does really is to take the standard answers that Feynman theory gives you and then translate them into twister space, which is all right for a while, but then you really want an internally motivated and internally driven approach to the subject. But there's another point I wanted to make, which is closer to what twister string does. It's one approach to twister string theory, which is the one that, to me, gives it the most substance. And I think maybe this is the thing to follow. Witten has approached this in this way, but not in the way that I've been able to understand. But the idea is that twister theory is, in a certain sense, like a topological quantum field theory. Because you don't have local field equations. The contour integrals, for instance, that I wrote down, somehow the field equations have evaporated on you. There's a homogeneity rule, but there isn't anything like a field equation in that. And this happens to an even more striking degree when you look at the nonlinear graviton. You see somehow the Einstein equations have just disappeared. They're contained in non-local structures in twister space. Now that's very much like a topological quantum field theory. Although it's a sort of holomorphic topological quantum field theory, where you don't have local field equations. You just have information contained in global structure. Now, in one of Witten's approaches to the subject, he looks at it that way, and he says, okay, Let's think of a topological quantum field theory. What's a holomorphic topological quantum field theory? And that leads you to a sort of string theory, which is, here's the main part of it which I don't understand. I've not really followed that up, but I'd like to. That somehow you're led naturally to a string theory by thinking of a topological quantum field theory. So it's a quantum field theory of the type that prior to this people had just thought was mathematics, you see. There's no physics in that. Where are the dynamics, you see? But mathematically these things are interesting in to studying knots and links and so on. So the sort of string theory is useful in mathematics. Now here I'm suggesting, or Witten was suggesting, that maybe string theory ideas are useful in physics via twister theory. Because twister theory, you don't want local field equations. So what you want is a sort of topological quantum field theory in twister space. And that would give you a theory which, when you translate to space-time, gives you dynamics and all that. So this is, I think that's the real way to go, probably. I would think that's very likely the route one should follow. And I wish I understood it better. I was there was a conference recently in Oxford, and I thought, at least at the end of the week, I'll understand that. And unfortunately, nobody described it. They were talking about other things. I would like to have seen that explained to me better, because I think that's the route I'd like to follow, which really does show you, I think, why the string ideas should be useful in twister theory.
What is the notion like locality of interactions in ordinary space-time translating to twister space?
Well, it's turned upside down. This was partly one of the original motivations of twister theory, because I felt, okay, because of EPR things, you wanted to see, you know, can you have a geometry in which non-local things somehow fit naturally? And it certainly, some things are local in space-time which are non-local in twister space, such things as curvature and field values and so on. Some things are local in twister space which are non-local in space-time. So you actually get an upside-down kind of... The correspondence initially is non-local, you see, the lines and points and things. It's a non-local correspondence. But it's more than that, because once you go to the cohomology, these things which I sort of vaguely describe, there is a non-localness also in that. And so you definitely have non-local aspects to things which could show up as non-local features of physics. But that's just a very general statement. It doesn't specifically say how EPR effects somehow show up as natural things from the twister point of view.
But more concretely, how do we make a rule like minima or coupling in ordinary space-time field theory in a twister space?
I don't think I can give you a short answer to that. I don't know. Because it certainly doesn't obviously translate to something in like local or something. No, it's not clear.
Actually, where are you in your talk?
Sorry?
Where are you in your talk?
The talk that I'm about to give.
No, the talk that you are now giving.
Oh, I was sorry. I was assuming I'd finished it.
We'd finish it. Well, then I propose, I hear the lattice gauge there is eating up all the biscuits outside.
Well, they know how to...
I propose we applause and people can ask their questions over tea.
Yes.
So.